name's Ruth and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
I wanted to say thank you first to Ari for having the strength. Well, okay, first of all, I have a daughter named Ari. Interesting fact. I wanted to say thank you to you for having the courage to share about the way the lying started for you and the food issue. My little sister struggles with an eating disorder, and I know we all laughed, but that is a very serious problem as well, and it is, I'm not saying that you have that, but I'm just, for me, it's very personal, and I have memories of, probably wasn't one of my first lies, but 7 or 8 years old and sneaking a bag of potato chips into the closet. It was a control thing, you know? It was about, okay, I've got my little stash, right? And so I really appreciated that you had the guts to say that and to be real about who you are, and I think that that is huge and important, and it's something that I found here and really very few other places in life, so thank you. Okay, I'm going to start with some of those preliminaries if I can remember them. I already did the alcoholic thing. My sobriety date is September 27th of the year 2000. I have a sponsor. She's in Largo. And she's awesome. And actually, that's an interesting fact as well. So we moved down here, my husband and I moved down here about 6 years ago, 7 years ago now. And it took me a very long time to get a sponsor in Florida. I wanted to hold on to my Virginia sponsor. And ironically enough, and I honestly did not put this together for several years. Okay, you're going to laugh. My grand sponsor of the sponsor in Virginia had moved to Largo about a year before we moved. Okay? Yeah, I know. So anyway, I hadn't thought of that for several years. And then finally, I guess when I got ready and when the pain of trying to do a long-distance sponsorship relationship got great enough, I thought to ask the lady who is currently my sponsor. So, just interesting fact. Okay, I grew up, like I said, I guess in Charlottesville, Virginia. And I entered into a family that now I can look back and say had a fair amount of dysfunction. At the time and growing up and for years and years and years, even as an adult, I did not recognize that. I could not recognize that. I didn't know. I knew that at about, I thought I had the perfect family growing up. And I was never abused or anything. It's not like I was beaten or whatever. We were always provided for. About the age of 10, I started to feel some of those feelings that Ari mentioned. Started to notice the differences. Notice the fact that, you know, I just couldn't measure up. I couldn't fit in with the people in my life. And, oh, disclaimer, I'm going to cry, so if that makes you uncomfortable, you can step out. I was not and could not measure up to what I believed I was supposed to be in life and what I believed was required in order for me to be human and in order for me to be worth something. And that was a very devastating realization. And I just kind of lived with that and dwelled in that for about 4 years. And when I was 14, that's when I picked up the first drink and the first drug. And to me, they went together immediately and from there on. you know, just add to the isms. One of the things that I came to realize, because this when I started doing some work on this in the last few years and started to realize some of the action that there was actually dysfunction in my family and I just wasn't the black sheep crazy ball person like out there on the side. The sticking point for me was, but I wasn't abused. I know you're saying I have the mentality of an abused person, but I wasn't abused. I was never abused. And finally, what I came to with that is I realized that, you know, and whatever my parents' past is, I don't know. I haven't had the courage to ask them yet. But it is what it is. I watched and learned from what they did so much more than from what they said. And they may have never told me that I was a piece of shit and not worth living. Oh, sorry, Christine. But they believed that to be true about themselves. And in the way they treated them, or from the way they treated themselves, I learned that that's how I'm supposed to be. And in order to be, like, a good person, I have to think I'm a piece of crap. Like, that's, it sounds crazy saying it out loud, but it's certainly a mentality that I think makes sense, and I would assume makes sense to people here. Please don't look at me like that. Okay. And that's, again, a realization that has come with some intensive work and over time. It wasn't something that I could get to as a teenager. It wasn't something that I could get to in early adulthood. So that's kind of, and my, on top of that, my parents had, I guess it's probably part of their solution, they had found religion, and religion was extremely important. I was homeschooled until I was in ninth grade because public schools are bad. And now I agree with them. I teach at a public school now, so now I think I get why. Anyway, public schools were bad, and so I was homeschooled, and the only social interaction I had at all, really, growing up was church kids. And there's nothing wrong with church kids, but there were certainly messages that, because of what I guess was experiencing at home, the messages that I was getting at church kind of reinforced a lot of that stuff and reinforced these shame-based beliefs that I really am not worth anything. And I smile when I say that, but it's not funny. And so at the age of 10, that became too much, and at the age of 14, I found a solution: alcohol and drugs. Before that, I should add, I really should add, before that, I found another solution. I found male attention. And that really, I think, was probably one of my first drugs. If you thought I was cute, or you were attracted to me, that made me okay. And then when I had alcohol and drugs, if you know, I just didn't have to feel, and I didn't have to have that crap in my head running about how I just cannot be like you, and I cannot be cool like you, and I can't be good like you. If I could shut that off for a little bit, I was okay. And that's what those drugs did for me. So I started using at the age of 14, and I made it 6 months before it became really apparent, and my parents intervened. It definitely, for me, that stuff moved quickly. I mean, I went from, here's the first time I'm trying it, to, okay, let's sneak out on the weekends, and then, okay, that's not enough, so let's sneak out on school nights, and then, okay, well, that's really not enough, so how about I run away for a few days so I can just get high the entire time? And do whatever I want and go wherever I want and have that feeling of power and control. And so that continued, and I continued to put myself in very risky situations until about 6 months later, in November of 1999, when I ran away for the last time from home, and I was gone for 3 weeks. And I wouldn't call or anything. It's not like I'd be like, hey guys, by the way, I'm over here. Because that would have ended the control. That would have ended the sense of power. And so, and my intention that time was to stay gone. I had found a guy that I was living with, kind of, living with his grandparents, because he lived in his grandparents' basement and got high every day, which was great. And he was 19, which was also great. And we were going to move to California, and we were going to have a life together. We were going to build a life together over there, and I could leave behind all of the things that I could never be. And now, of course, since I'd done drugs and gotten high and had sex and all these other things, now I definitely could not ever be that person that I was supposed to be. And that fell into shambles. One night, my parents figured out where I was through probably some jealous little girl downtown. And they... she was, okay. And we came home that night, or to his grandparents' house that night, and they knew that I wasn't 20, like I told them. And they knew that I was actually wanted elsewhere, and I was not privy to the conversation that he had with them, but the next morning he took me over to this, like, burned out abandoned church on the side of a highway, and he said, wait here and I'll come back. I said, okay. And so I sat in that church from 10 in the morning, I think, approximately, to about 5 p.m. And it was Virginia. You know, it was winter time, so it was cold. And it got dark quickly. So it was getting dark, and he still hadn't come back, and I was kind of starting to wonder. Well, I'd been wondering for hours. And a car pulled into the driveway, and so I came outside all excited, and like, okay, he's finally back, right? And instead, a couple of plainclothes officers stepped out, and once they had me under physical control, they revealed who they were. And for me, that experience was very, very powerful because it reinforced in a huge way all of those shame-based beliefs. You know, here was a situation and I built this all up and I was going to have this life and I was finally going to be okay in like a new way, in my own way. And then that was crushed, you know, and I found out that I really wasn't good enough still. And now, not only was I not good enough for, you know, my parents and their world, but I wasn't good enough for my own world that I built up too, which was very devastating. And so I went to a holding cell, and I was talking about wanting to take a whole lot of pills. I just want to go home and take some pills. And I guess you shouldn't say that to police officers, because they take you seriously. So, and they have to. So instead of going home, I went to a psych ward for a few days, which is also very cold and, like, clean and sterile and a very uncomfortable experience. And then I came home. And I wasn't there for all that long. My parents decided that after that experience, it was time for me to take a trip. So they sent me to a private boarding school in Hancock, New York, that had an added program based on the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And actually, I think the sister group for YPG down here up in Virginia is formed or was formed initially by some of the alumni of that school, oddly enough. Very strange. Anyway, so I went there and I stayed there for, well, okay, it's an 18-month program, or it's supposed to be an 18-month program, which is extensive to begin with. And I was there for 3.5 years. Yeah, I know. So, I was not willing to accept the fact that I was powerless at all for a long time. So, for the first 2 years of my experience there, I really spent a lot of time lying. And honestly, I experienced powerless and unmanageability in my life with lying long before I ever understood it with drugs or alcohol or anything else. That was one of the first things that I found because, again, it was about the control. Okay, you put me on an inventory card, and every day I got to sit down with somebody and go over these things that I'm thinking and what's going on. But I wasn't going to tell you the whole truth. I would tell you, like, I lusted after somebody, but I would say a different name. And I was like, then who it actually was? And I really don't have any other explanation than that this was over. It was about control, and it was about keeping people out. Because ultimately it came down to the fact that, you know, I really truly believed that if you, and you know what, this belief is so prevalent in my life today still. It's sad. If you really knew who I was, and if I actually let you in enough for you to see who I was, like with everything, you know, there is no way in hell you'd stick around. And I believe that so firmly, and I have believed that so firmly for a long time. So I fought for a long time, and I ran away from that school 6 times unsuccessfully. There are actually some funny stories in that, too, surprisingly. And I pushed, and I flipped what they called flipping out, you know, like I'd start throwing punches and screaming and stuff, and they'd restrain you, and then they'd take you to the little padded room down the hall in the back of the gymnasium, and with the little 3 locks on it, and the carpet on the walls, it smelled like pee, because people peed in there. I did. It was disgusting. Anyway, and I spent my fair share of time in there, and I thought I was crazy. You know, after a couple years, I really was like, this is getting insane. Like, I know that all I have to do is just follow the little rules and be honest and tell them what's going on in my head, and I couldn't freaking do it. I couldn't do it. And I would try, and I'd get like a month of being honest and being real. And then I couldn't do it anymore. And I'd lie about something intentionally. I knew I was lying. I don't know. So that struggle went on for a very, very, very long time. And I really don't know. There wasn't, when I guess it flipped for me, or it turned, or I hit bottom, I guess is what we say. There wasn't anything big or grandiose or different, you know. It was just another day, another conversation with my sponsor at the school, another time of her asking me, so when's it going to change, Ruth? And that face, and me being like, I don't know. And I don't know. I don't know. But I know that something did change, and that for whatever reason, that 15 millionth time that she said, when's it going to change, somehow made a difference. And I said, okay, I'm going to try it, like, for real, and I've tried it before, and I don't think it's going to work, and I think that I'm going to fall on my ass again, but I'm going to try. And so I started trying to be honest one day at a time. And I walked through the first 9 steps with that sponsor at the school. And I kept going, and I had things happen, like, a week before I was supposed to graduate, I got in trouble for not taking pictures. At a field trip that we went on. I was in journalism, so I was supposed to take pictures. Anyway, I got in trouble in journalism, and everything, I mean, school and the house, and everybody was, you know, it's a boarding school, so we're all right there. So everything you did was like, everybody knew everything you did. And I didn't take pictures, and I got in trouble. And the teacher happened to be part of my family group as well. And so It was a very mortifying experience, and he decided to really just throw everything he possibly could at me. And so I was put in the corner, and I guess this takes some back explanation, I'm sorry. Yeah, when I say put in the corner, they would literally have you sit in the corner facing the wall. They'd take your shoes, because then you were obviously a runaway threat. And so I was put in the corner. I was put on work sanction. And, okay, work sanction is when you get taken out of school and you have to, like, go outside and do manual labor instead of doing school. Okay. And these are like the heavy hitter sanctions, right? The things that they throw at the really, really stubborn kids that nobody likes. So I was in the corner and on work sanction, and it was a week before graduation. And I was like, there's no, or maybe it was a month, but I was like, there's no way I'm going to graduate. And I wanted to run. And there have been a lot of times in my life since then, and way before then, in which my response to life getting tough is just to run. Just to say, F it all. And run away. And that's what I did when I was out there drinking and drugging. And that's what I did for the first 2 years at the school. And it seemed a very simple solution. And at that point, I was 18 years old. They wouldn't have chased me this time. Like, I could have gotten away. And I didn't. I didn't run. I stayed there. And I was so mad. Like, I could not speak for hours after that. And I didn't flip out. I didn't have to go back to the little pee-pee isolation room. I did. And I stayed. And I, you know, within a couple days, I think somebody must have probably gone to him and said something about, you know, that's a little harsh, maybe. But I stayed. And I tried to stay open. And I tried to talk once I could. Once I could speak again, I tried to talk. And I graduated. Surprisingly enough. And I left there and went out into the real world, which was terrifying. I don't, if anybody's been to rehab here, that, like, that week before you're going out into the real world is always terrifying. And I stayed sober, and nobody thought I was going to stay sober there. They all, I actually had people tell me straight to my face, like, we don't think you're, but we hope you do. Good luck. And so I left and I went to a meeting, which is what they told us to do. I was genuinely scared, because I knew that the life that I'd been leading before the school and during those first 2 years, I couldn't keep doing that anymore. It was like a meager, bare existence, and that was just not really an option. So it was kind of either death or something different. So I went to a meeting and I raised my hand and I said, hey, I'm new to the area, and you guys know how y'all responded, because that's how you are. And I got involved, and I went to college, and I stayed sober in college. That's always like a crazy fact, I think. Like, I stayed sober through college. And I missed a lot of parties, I'm sure, but that's okay. And I fumbled around a lot. I mean, it hasn't been a very straight road. I got a sponsor, and this is funny. I'm sorry. So, my first sponsor, I remember I'd made a year commitment to no relationships, which I really didn't think I was going to be able to keep, but I knew it was important. And I made it within, like, almost. I had, like, a week left, I think, and I ended up kissing somebody. But I was like, I was really close, man. And that was a long freaking time. But I remember going to my sponsor at one point and sharing, you know, some of this angst that I was feeling because I'd been locked away for the entirety of my teenage years. And so relationships were kind of something I was doing, like, high school mode in college. Not fun. And she suggested, I don't know if I can share this. I guess it's okay. Okay, all right, I'm sorry. If I offend anyone, I'm going to apologize in advance, okay? So she suggested, since I was struggling, that, well, you know, you can get a toy or something. Like, it's okay. And I was horrified. I was like, oh, my God, that's not okay. Because, you know, the religious background, and then the school had reinforced a lot of that stuff. So it was completely mind-blowing that, you know, that would be part of self-care. And she was like, well, it's better than sleeping around a lot. And I was like, well. I think that to say that I've definitely had gotten a lot out of a sponsorship relationship. And that's okay. Oh, well. But I really have. You know, that's my ideas are not always the best, and they're not always right. And that is one thing that, you know, having a sponsor has really done for me repeatedly throughout life, is bringing a new perspective, bringing other ideas, bringing some sanity when I don't have any, because that still happens last night. So made it through college without getting drunk or getting high, but what I've found is, and this is, again, proved true throughout my life, just not drinking for me is definitely not the solution, because of all that ism stuff that I started with. And left to my own devices, without drugs or alcohol, I very quickly end up right back where I started as far as all of those belief systems go. And so there were several points in college during which I wanted to drink very, very badly, or I got into a position. One of my other things I hadn't mentioned yet, I'm sorry, was cutting, like physical attack or whatever. And so that, interestingly enough, I found has become more prevalent because I'm not getting drunk, right? So it's okay, and I'm not relapsing, right? But really, for me, that is just as much a relapse as getting high or drunk, and it's something that is less noticeable for some people if you take care. Anyway, but it's something that, you know, and I found myself, and I don't know why this is the incident that's coming to mind, but I guess I'll share it because it's coming to mind. So I remember having a conversation at one point with my roommate, and they wanted to talk to me because I wasn't around enough. I kept very busy. I had to. I wasn't around enough, and because I wasn't, like, cleaning enough or helping out enough. And saying it now, I realize that's not really a big deal. But at the time, to have someone confront me with that information, obviously that means I do not deserve to live. If I have not been, like, upholding these expectations, then I'm just, like, I don't deserve to live, and I shouldn't be here, and obviously they never want to see me again, and they just wish I were dead, and, like, that, again, ironically enough, but this is, and I know it sounds crazy, like, that is a little bit heavy of a response there, But that's where I was at. And I wanted, like, I had to call somebody in AA and go to freaking IHOP until 3 a.m, you know, to, like, get over it. Thank you. And to avoid cutting. Because really, and that was, I think, one of the wake-up moments for me with that situation. Because I wanted to drink, yeah, but not that badly. What I really, really wanted to do in response to that situation was harm myself. And I guess that should have been a clue that there was something still a little bit off. So, made it through college. I graduated. Continued to work with my sponsor at the time. Oh, okay, here we go. In my last year of college, I got too busy for AA. That was not a good thing. I allowed my life to become more important than my recovery. And as a result of that, I got very crazy. And I went, you know, I actually faced some very big life situations. Like, I teach now, and I was going through, like, the teacher training period at that point where you, like, are in a school and you're teaching, but you have a real teacher who you're, like, kind of under, and they supervise you and they mentor you. And my supervising teacher passed away that year in the midst of that program, and I ended up kind of filling in for her until the end of the year. And so there was a lot going on that I really would have benefited from, you know, having these strong relationships in AA, and I thought I could handle it. And I think, too, looking back now, I think some of that probably had to do with having gotten a little too close. And y'all knew me a little bit better than I wanted you to. And so I had to back out a little. And I did. And then, again, the pain got great enough. And fortunately for me, I did not end up going back out and drinking or picking up a drug. Although, again, there were lots of nights in which I wanted to. But I came back and met my now husband. And he would probably not be very happy with me if I forgot to mention the fact that I 13th stepped him. Whatever. Anyway. We waited until he had a year, okay? Came back. And the really, really neat thing about coming back into the program that time was I built relationships with women. Like, real, real strong. I mean, there was, like, a step group going on Monday nights at this one lady's house. And I got involved with that step group. It was so awesome. And we'd go over to her house every Monday night, and we were working through this, like, step booklet together. And that group of women, I had not gotten since the family school, which was a little artificial because I was a teenager, and I don't think you can know yourself that well when you're a teenager. Since I had not gotten that close with a group of women, and they still, you know, they weren't running away. Like, they weren't looking at me and being like, I don't know about that one. And it was just a really, really beautiful experience, and I loved going through the steps with them. And it was scary. It was scary to go in there and be honest and say what was going on. But through that process, again, I built relationships with these women. And they didn't run away from me. And even when I did stupid things, like I hung up on my sponsor one time because she told me something I really, really didn't like, and I was already in one of those, like, shame spirals. And so I hung up on her, and I was, like, sobbing. And I was like, oh, my God, I just hung up on my sponsor. And so I'm going to drink. So I went to Lainey's house. And you guys don't know Lainey, but she's awesome. And I just went over there. I didn't even call her, I don't think. I just showed up at her house, and I was like, and she, you know, she didn't look at me and say, you hung up on your sponsor? You know, she invited me in, and we sat on the back porch, and we talked until I calmed down, and I could call me back and be like, look, I'm sorry. And work through it. And, again, I have to be willing to open up and be honest about who I am, even when that person is kind of ugly. Because honestly, we're all a little ugly sometimes. Or our behavior's ugly, at least, you know? And so, that was a really cool experience, and that I think kind of encapsulates what those relationships meant for me, because I hadn't really had that. You know, we didn't talk growing up. We didn't talk about what was going on, really going. Oh, definitely not what was really going on. We would talk about God, and we'd talk about church, and I mean, we'd get into light conversations and stuff. But I really don't remember having a like, so how are you feeling? Conversation with either of my parents. Ever? I don't think. And wait, later I'm going to find out that's a lie and I'm going to have to come back and tell you. So developed relationships with women, steps. This character was moving to Florida. He was getting medically retired from the Marine Corps and was moving to Florida. And that was... I guess I had a choice to make, and it was a very difficult choice for me. I didn't really know how to handle that, and I was able to, because of the relationships I'd built with all these women, turn to someone with it. And I did. I turned to them, and what I found through that process was I couldn't get like a straight answer out of anybody. You know, I'd be like, so what should I do? Should I move to Florida or should I stay in Virginia? And they'd be like, half of them would say, follow your heart. And then half of them would say, a third would say, follow your heart. A third said, stay here, that's scary, ew. The other third said, you know, no, you should totally go for it. I mean, even if you come back, it's an awesome experience. And so I wasn't getting, you know, an answer. And I finally just had to make a freaking decision. And that was an interesting lesson, you know, that, like, it's not, I'm not always going to get a very clear cut. Like, we have the steps and their guidelines, and we have the principles and their guidelines, but for every single little life situation that I come across, I can apply the principles, and I can apply the steps, but that doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to get the little, you should do this route answer. So, I decided to come here. And, but I'm glad I did. Florida has some really, really wonderful people. But I will say that move was very, very difficult. And you guys were not Fredericksburg, Virginia. Okay? And you did things differently. And you had, like, a different chip system, and that was aggravating. And, like, it's annoying. And you had different personalities, and it just wasn't the same. And so it was making that transition, and I'm sure any of you who have moved in here before know exactly what I'm talking about. It's just difficult, and it's awkward, and it's uncomfortable to kind of rebuild and reestablish those relationships. And I just really didn't for a long time. I spent a lot of time kind of going to meetings and being like, hey, what's up? And maintaining this, like, nice level of aloofness where I'm safe, and you don't know me, so you can't run away. And I really continued to do that through getting married, through having our first child. And it was after our first child was born, I hit a couple walls. Not that, you know, there were new problems or new isms necessarily. It was the same old isms. But I did not, after having our first child, I did not have the same freedom that I did to just be like, oh, well, I'm pissed off, so I'm just going to a meeting. Fuck it. You know, or there just wasn't the flexibility and there wasn't the same amount of time. And so a lot of those things that I'd been avoiding by flitting through meetings and not knowing people really caught up with me. And I went into therapy. That's another interesting story, actually. It's something that my husband's also in AA. I know you know that. I don't know why I'm telling you that. Anyway, we'd been talking about it for a while, and he'd been gently encouraging me to seek help. And I had been resisting because I don't need help. And at least not that kind of help. And so I got to a point where there was a night that he went to a meeting and he left, and I hadn't been able to say, you know, I really want to go to a meeting, or, you know, I'm really feeling very crazy and I could use some support. I couldn't say those things because, again, I was all twisted up in my head, and if I needed help or I needed support, then he was going to run away. And so he left, and I wanted to break stuff, and I wanted to break me, really. But I knew I couldn't do that, and I knew I couldn't drink. And so we had this little candy bouquet of flowers or whatever, from Easter or something, I don't know. And so I smashed that, something. And I punched a cabinet, and then I called somebody, and I called someone. This was the scary thing. I had a pretty good amount of numbers. I had people I could call, but I couldn't call any of them because they weren't going to understand the level of crazy that was going on right then, and they weren't going to understand breaking the damn candy flower bouquet. That's just childish. And there was one person in my list of numbers that I was I've heard her share in meetings, and she might just understand. Thank God she shares like she does. So I called her, and she understood, and she was like, "Well, if you're seriously considering therapy, I know somebody, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera." And I said, "Okay, fine, I'll take the number and I'll call, but I'm not going to tell Andre for a month." And I told him the next day. Again, my story, it's been a long road, and it continues to be a long road, and, I guess the one thing I can say about sobriety is, it's a journey. That sounds so cliche, but it's true. It's very true. So I sought help, and through that outside-inside help, because that person is also in recovery, so. So through my outside-inside help, that's where I've really been. It's basically been a major fourth step, and a really intense fourth step. And I've learned a lot of things that, even though I did a fourth step when I was 15 or 16 years old, that was real thorough, it was. It just wasn't quite good enough. And it wasn't good enough because I didn't have perspective. I was so stuck in it, I couldn't see it. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about recovery for me today is that, and the very uncomfortable things about recovery today, there is still stuff that I'm sure I am not seeing, or that I don't see, or that I don't recognize yet. And that growth for those things that I don't see and I don't recognize, or I'm just starting to see and just starting to recognize, is so dang painful. But it is so worthwhile as well. And it's kind of necessary, because without that, it's kind of keep moving forward or go drink. So, and we know where that would end me up. So I got pregnant again, and not right now, but a couple years ago. and I was in, working through some stuff in therapy and everything, and one of the really neat opportunities that I had because of that was that I got to do something different with this second pregnancy, and I got to sit down and say, okay, what were some of the things that were incredibly difficult for me going through the first pregnancy and coming out of that first pregnancy? Because I don't know, the first couple weeks after having a baby really, really suck a lot. So one of the things on my list was I needed friends. I needed to establish, and it didn't have to be a ton of people, because again, I don't really want you to know me that well. But I needed a couple people to whom I could turn, so I didn't end up smashing the damn candy bouquet again, right? I didn't want to go back there again. And so I began active, and I didn't know this, guys. When you work on a relationship, you have to act, it takes work. I didn't know that. I really didn't know that. So I actively began pursuing I selected two women who had kids, and they were same life situation and everything, and in AA and everything, and I started pursuing them as friends. And I did, it sounds really crazy, but I actively had to seek after them and call them intentionally, stuff that we do when we first come in that I'd forgotten how to do. And those women are such a blessing in my life today, and I realize I'm at 30 seconds probably at this point. So I guess I'm wrapping up with that, but it's